control the rotor speed within a 10 RPM, what we call a dead band. Essentially, the machine is designed to operate between 130 and 140 RPM at maximum rated speed. And as the wind goes above 29 miles per hour, the blades will change their pitch just to keep this RPM.
So it doesn't increase?
So it doesn't increase, right.
Why is that?
Well, we don't want it to, it'll, at 130 RPM, we're putting out the 20 kilowatts. If we go above that with this synchronous inverter, you're supplying more power than it can use. You're oversupplying the system and it will cut off. And the windmill itself is designed to go up to a maximum of 30 miles per hour. So we just don't want to have the blades over speed. This is where you can develop some higher stresses in the blade and blade stub combination. And as far as icing goes, we have experienced icing out of the lagoon, and the blades are coated with a material to try and keep the icing from staying to the blades. And up till this date, the ice has been ejected from the blades, and we're kind of anxious to see how we go through another winter, see what happens up there. Changes we've incorporated from the last windmill to this one is we've strengthened all structural members within the wind system itself. We've added bearings to the blade stubs. We feel we need redundant load pads on the system itself. We've eliminated what we considered weakened interfaces on the system where the blades do go into the hub assembly itself. We've strengthened the tower interface and we supplied a new tower, and we are in the process of adding automatic cutoffs in case we encounter vibration again. This is not as simple as it sounds because the machine itself has a mini computer within it, which takes rotor speed, power that's being generated, and translates this into a blade pitch angle. And what we are doing at this time is trying to integrate a system with a vibration pickup that if the machine itself starts vibrating, will automatically go to feather and eliminate any of the problems we've had in the past. We have tried this in a lab and actually once out of the lagoon and found that we really need a little more development in it. It's probably about 3 to 4 months away from incorporation. It's not that simple to include these automatic devices. It's you design them for one particular job, and you'll find that you'll do 3 or 4 more that you hadn't planned on. So this is coming, but right now we've got an emergency feather switch, which is in the powerhouse, and if someone suspects that the machine isn't operating, they hit the switch, it'll automatically go to feather. Now, that's really all I've got on a brief presentation. I'll answer any questions on the machine itself.
Mr. Rode, what's it cost per kilowatt hour? It may be in this report lab.
We'd like to find that out up there. Our predictions are we're in the 20 to 25 cent per kilowatt hour range.
What is it for fuel?
They're paying $1.05 a gallon for fuel. Right?
Yeah, but what? Oh, how many kilowatt hours a gallon of fuel?
I don't know that
right off the
So we're right in that competitive range. Really, is we'd like to run it for at least a year to see what kind of power we can put out.
Did you, Mr. Oakley? What kind of arrangements do you have? Do you do the people pay make any contribution to the power that's generated by the machine?
The agreement that we've reached with the villagers. Is that the state owns the diesel system and the grid and the wind turbine. The village has is establishing a small utility system as part of their village corporation, and they will be responsible for running the diesel generators and for billing for power, and it'll be the total power produced. The state is responsible for the wind generation system itself. The agreement is that once the life of the demonstration is over, that the village will receive ownership of the diesels and the electrical system and the wind turbine. In essence, they'll be a totally independent utility serving their needs out there.
Where it's the state budget gives it to that purchasing?
Yes, sir, at a later date. Mr.
Chairman. Mr. Buckle.
I'd like to ask, what was their source of energy before you went into Nelson Lagoon?
They each had individual diesel generators on their homes. Each home had one.
Okay, are they still using those?
No. They haven't used them for a year.
I haven't had time to look through the material that you distributed here, but let's get back to the original, if you would, please. The original $250,000, how did you spend that? What was it?
How much went for what, the breakdown? Approximately $50,000 has gone to Kotzebue, and the balance has gone to Nelson Lagoon.
No, that wasn't really my question.
Oh.
Okay, let's take the remaining $200,000. Let's leave Kotzebue out of it.
Okay.
How much did you spend for the machines? How much did you spend for this? How much did you spend for that?
Okay, I don't have it handy, but very briefly, the machine itself was $20,000. The synchronous inverter was $6,000. The supporting spare parts package, which was also included, was $2,000. Those were all FOB Houston, and we shipped them to Anchorage. The bulk of the expenditures, the installation of the electrical distribution grid was, as I recall, approximately $80,000. The balance of the funding was for labor.
This is all for the old system?
Correct.
What was your question, Mr. Meekin?
So that was for the old system, the one that broke. All those costs.
I'm still having problems. Do we have two systems, two machines that are exactly alike?
No, sir. Just the one big one there, and then the small one in Kotzebue.
I thought you said you had three of them.
Originally, it was to be three.
I probably should have pursued this in the beginning. That's the question I asked you in the beginning. You started out, you were supposed to buy three machines.
Yeah, the original proposal or intent was to have three separate demonstrations.
So you ended up with one large one and one small one?
Yes, sir.
Okay, and the complete installation at Kotzebue cost you how much?
$50,000.
So that would leave $200,000 for the one that went haywire?
Yes, sir.
And that's what I was trying to find out, is how much money we had in this thing, and frankly, I'm quite skeptical why you need another $58,000. That's the gist of my questioning, frankly, and it would seem to me that we should have
the total of $200,000 was expended, or almost all of it. Okay, all of it was expended on the original installation, except for a small reserve to handle in case there was something that went wrong. And when we had our failure, basically the state was in a position that we did not have the funding available to buy a new tower, to get a new machine out there, and to get it up and running again. And as a result...
Okay, now, again, the question that's in my mind, if you spent $200,000 total, well, I suppose you could take off $80,000, I think you said, for the grid, but I'm trying to get down to the machine itself.
Yes, sir.
If you spend X number of thousands of dollars for the machine, and it only ran a month before it went gunny sack, my question is, why should the state spend any money at all? Why didn't you have some kind of a guarantee or something that, you know, that it would, I would think that's normal procedure, is it not?
Yes, sir. It's a product. Well, number one, originally Grumman's involvement was only as a supplier of the wind turbine and of the synchronous inverter. The contract that we had with Grumman said that if there were problems with the machine and it did need to be replaced, they would replace the wind turbine, and they were willing to back up their product. when the failure occurred, We didn't know exactly what happened. Was it their machine that caused the tower to go down, or was the tower that caused their machine to go down? Their only contractual obligation, because they were a supplier, was just to provide us with a new wind turbine. If we would have left it at that, we would have had a new wind turbine sitting in Anchorage with no capability of getting the installation back up and operating again.
I'm not really concerned whether it was Grumman or Joe Doe or somebody
yes,
else.
Sir.
When the state spent less than $200,000 in the machine, why didn't they do it on the normal procedure that you would expect anybody to do that would have a delivered, guaranteed product on their hands?
Well, it's an experimental machine. It's a demonstration machine.
I thought you told me earlier that it was not a prototype.
That's the one at Kotzebue.
The one at Kotzebue is not. It's a commercially available product.
And it's working?
No, sir.
Part of the time.
Generators fell.
The generators screwed up and it's going to be replaced.
At the expense of the
manufacturer. Correct.
Mr. Beacon? No, I think they did have some kind of a guarantee on the prototype, even though it was a prototype. They did back up their product. But the problem is that to the extent that the failure was in the tower, I mean, who was responsible for the tower?
We were responsible.
The state was?
Correct.
I think that's the problem. If they're blaming the tower and the Grumman didn't make the tower, so they're not backing it up.
Well, you know, we got to a point is you have a failed machine, and we still don't know exactly what went wrong. We could have pressed it with Grumman and said, well, it's your machine that started shaking up there, and therefore it's your fault that the tower came. Or vice versa, they could have pressed the point.
Let's put it this way. Is this $58,000 paying for the, what do you call it?
Reinstalling.
The machine itself, what do you call it? Turbine? Is it paying for that?
No, it's paying for the total reinstallation. Actually,
they are replacing the turbine, even though it's not
correct.
Yeah, you did bring in a new one.
Yeah, we brought in a brand new wind machine, modified it somewhat. Most of the money that's included in the $58,000 will be paid to a local Alaskan contractor for his reinstallation services.
Okay.
Well, some $40,000 in money for the contractor.
Mr. Chairman, I think that I have the same concern you do. But if they're Grumman's essentially you're putting up the money to replace the wind machine.
Yes, and
what's being asked for here is the money to reimburse the installation.
It might be helpful for Dick to tell you the type of expenses that Grumman has put out that they are getting absolutely no reimbursement for, what they've spent to date.
To date, we've spent almost $300,000 on this particular project, of which we were initially funded by the state for $34,000 for the initial unit. That was the extent of our involvement. When the system went down, we replaced the unit and agreed to finance basically the program to date to get a new unit up and operational. So to date, we've spent $300,000. If this supplemental budget is approved, we would have received totally around $90,000. And of that $90,000, well over $50,000 is going back to the Alaskan contractor for the installation services. And that's basically some kind of course we're looking
at. I don't quarrel with those, but coming from the other side, from the state side of it, at this point we have, at least in this one unit, we have $200,000 of the state's money involved. Apparently we don't have something that lasted a month. Whose fault it is, I don't know, but it seems obvious to me that somebody is fault. I don't know who, that would be a question that we could ask and we could presume to find out who, at the state level, decided that they were qualified to design the tower, do whatever they did, and take over the thing that you people should have done. Somebody should have done, not necessarily you, but it seemed to me that the proper thing for the state to do was to decide, how much, they knew how much money they had to spend. And as who'll buy a unit, contract for a unit, have it put up there. Somebody would be there under that warranty, would be responsible for providing him with a machine that worked and up for a period of time, a year or whatever. And if it didn't work, well, then whoever supplied it would have a responsibility to do that. But that apparently hasn't happened yet. It seems to me, frankly, like it's slightly fouled up. And I wouldn't personally, the rest of the members can speak for themselves, but personally, I would be a little reluctant to, you know, throw another $58,000 worth of state's money into the pot without having a real detailed analysis of what went on and where the money went and why.
Well, if I could explain the way the project was run, we had a management services contract with a local Alaskan contractor, and they basically were responsible for putting up the original installation. I wasn't in the project directly at this point in time. The towers were located at Cold Bay. It was felt that if the towers that were found at Cold Bay would pass the structural analysis, that it would be a good way to go as far as perhaps saving the state some money. We did obtain the designs for the towers at Cold Bay, and we determined how high they would have to be. They were originally 100-foot towers, and they were going to be cut down. Both our engineer and the Grumman engineers did stress analysis on that specific tower design. And the stress analysis was done on the assumption that the tower was structurally strong and all the members were what they should be. I would say that if there is a glitch that was made, it was not recognizing the fact that the way the FAA had dismantled these towers was by dynamiting them down. I did not know that this was the case at the time. I think that if indeed the fault is in the tower failure initially, that it is probably because this was the case, that one, even though the members were straight, they may not be structurally as strong as they would have been. Perhaps this was an oversight and not knowing this, but analysis was done on the design and it passed that analysis. And Grumman and our engineers were satisfied that that particular tower could undergo the type of stresses that would be placed upon it by this unit. And that's basically, you know, where we were coming from.
You should, you know.
In hindsight, you know.
Yeah, just an honest opinion, you shouldn't have been in the tower business.
I would
say, Mr. Chairman, that she's probably not at fault here. We had McConkie here with one of his windmills a couple of years ago, and last year probably the fault started right there.
I didn't mean the lady personally.
Okay.
All right. Could you how much trouble would it be for you to provide us with the figures as to how many dollars went for what?
I could do that for you.
Would you do that for us? For my own information, I'd like to see an actual breakdown as to how much went to, you know, pick the, you know, the one that, never mind the cuts, you want to concentrate on. So we have to know how many dollars went for the machine, how many dollars went for power, how many went for labor, you know.
Yeah, I have to. I will add, frankly, too, that some of my operating budget has been contributed to this, too. And I will include everything that's been spent today.
Mr. Meekins?
Chairman, are you desiring to pull the bill over?
I'm willing to abide by the knowledge, wisdom of the committee, but I suspect that the committee would not want to go to the floor with this.
You can hold over pending a staff for the finding out for the information.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, if she can deliver the breakdown of the information, I think we could have this outcome. I'm still surprised that half of it is hardware and half of it was something else. I was writing down the amount that was mentioned, and it's $92,000. That's not exactly accounted for, except perhaps labor. And then we have another supplemental for 58, which is supposedly for labor. I'd like to see what the 92,000 went to.
I have one question.
Mr.
What would happen if this supplemental was not approved? In other words, I guess the majority of the money would be going to the contractor. So I guess he'd be out of his money.
The supplemental was not approved. Grumman has already borne the cost.
We have.
And it's a part of the agreement. Before I leave, if I may, I'd just like to comment to make sure that this project was never intended to be a production unit. It has always been an experimental demonstration machine. It's, and the way we've used it, concept. It's we expected to run into problems, not the major one that we did, but it's demonstration, and I think that sort of changes the focus on the.
Wasn't the maybe with my concept was wrong, but my idea was that the demonstration zone wind was to demonstrate wind power, not research, you know, for some particular model. I assumed that when we went to the demonstration projects on wind power, that we would start with a proven product, you know, a design that worked, and see how that affected and worked in the communities. But I never envisioned that we would come up with an experimental plan to experiment with in the experimental wind power.
Maybe it'd help a little bit if Frank could tell you the other units that they have up and operating. This isn't the first unit, but it's the first unit in the Alaskan environment. And that's what we were intending to demonstrate, is how this unit can hold up in the climate that we're dealing with. Frank, where else are they?
Well, the first unit went to Federal IRTA out of Rocky Flats as a demonstrator. And the second unit went to Iowa State for an agricultural project. This is near Ames, Iowa. The third went to the United States Air Force in Cheyenne, Wyoming. The fourth one is a New York State demonstration project in upstate New York on a dairy farm. Georgia Tech also got the fifth model for a essentially research on a federal grant. Sixth one was here. Seventh one is a Grumman demonstrator. This one we keep in the Bethpage area. We sold one to the Navy for Hawaii. That hasn't been installed yet. But this is more or less where the projects have been going.
Mr. Beacon.
Yeah. Well, now in this second one, if the same thing happens again, how are we fixed on it?
Well, the state would basically be in the same place. We don't have the X thousands of dollars it would take to replace it.
Well, I mean, but the first time we were purchasing the tower, right?
In this case, the second installation, Grumman has been the prime manager of the project. They've been running it. They were responsible for the design of the tower. It's basically been their show for the reinstallation.
I mean, if the tower buckled, you know, or something like that, wouldn't they be responsible for that? In this case, I mean, what's the situation now?
Well, I guess Grumman would make sure that this program works. That's why we're here. We really haven't sat back and thought about any of the legalities involved. This tower, we're confident, will work. If it doesn't, then Grumman had made an error in judgment.
I think what the chairman's saying, if I'm understanding him, is that we should have never gotten into the tower business in the first place. We should have handled it the way we're handling it now. I'm not sure that's what you said.
Possibly that's true.
And if that's the case, then I'm just wondering.
The tower isn't a very simple part of the system. It's not like you're putting a static load sitting on top of this 40-foot tower. You're putting a 2,500-pound vibrating machine up there. And it's an area that Roman has learned a lot in through this program. It's also an area the federal government is pursuing independently. Is that in order to support the larger machines, you're going to have to figure out relatively commercially available power is simple to install and safe for the kind of loads that the tower is expected to carry.
Did the company have any concern at all about the capability or the knowledge of the static problems about the people that were just putting up this tower in the first place? But didn't that concern somebody? That you know there's problems that it's not like putting a water tank on the top of it or something. You have problems. Bother somebody that maybe we had people putting up power that didn't know what they were doing?
Well, as we looked at, that's why we insisted on looking at the original design of the tower. And that was handled by communications between Alaska and New York. They sent the prints to us. We evaluated the prints with the manufacturer of the tower. And we did a engineering analysis of the tower. The analysis said that the tower was sufficient for the loads. We did not know either that the tower was dynamited off the platform prior to installation.
Sir, what do you say? But I think that's a good question. We didn't go off and do this independently without no communication. In fact, Drummond had a structural engineer out there during the initial installation, and they had an electrical engineer out there. So the initial installation was not done without close coordination with Drummond.
I'll admit that's something that I wasn't quite clear in my mind. When you were saying we did analysis, for all I knew, it was you and the secretary in the back room.
No.
Okay. Mr.
I'm just curious, is this Drummond, is this the Drummond that makes the Drummond Goose?
Yes.
They made the Drummond Goose.
They haven't made Grumman Goose for
40
years.
Well, they're still flying. Well, we expect this unit to have the same quality as the Grumman Goose. And maybe second to the canoes.
Mr. Swanson.
Yeah, I think it might be well if we dug up the minutes of Mr. McConkie's statements at this table last year when we appropriated that money. And as I can't...
I hope the session doesn't...
Well, I'm not going anywhere anyway. Anyway, I would be interested to know, Mr. Chairman, if there was any federal dollars involved in this, or if we were eligible for federal dollars under that federal grant program for experiments in wind power generation, which there is a federal dollars available. I think this is a company that's old established company, and if they lost $58,000, they just write it off just like oil companies write off bad things, and just like any other company. So I would be really interested to see what Mr. McConkie promised this committee last year.
I'd be concerned. Would you so kind as to get the breakdown on the figures and all the detailed information. Right. We appreciate it.
I might comment, if I may, Mr. Swanson, that we did try and get federal dollars in it. We maintained a very close contact with the Department of Energy, and we tried to get them to contribute. Their particular approach to their wind programs is to put everything up, systems up at Rocky Flats in Boulder and test and analyze the machines there before they're willing to kick in any money for actual demonstrations in the field. The most we were able to get them to contribute was this instrumentation. We sure tried several times the other route.
Mr. Meekin, are you asking this question?
Yeah, well, I'm looking through this report, of course, I haven't a chance to look at it real closely, but it seems to me that, it says here that, it's just a guess, but a single WS-25B, whatever that is, could save approximately $7,390 annually. So, I'm just wondering, like, if you save $7,300, $7,400 every year, and it cost you, $200,000 to install, would that be... I mean, could I say that after so many years you'd be saving money, or just no?
Well, $200,000 includes a lot that would not be in the cost of the production unit. Once they go into production, the actual hardware cost might go down. You're going to have the mechanics of doing it down quite a bit. Installed cost, I think you're talking half or less, probably $65,000, $70,000, depending on.
All right, if you would be so kind to try those figures, we'll you get them back to us and we'll consider the bill at that time. And then we have the 115. The first item on the agenda will be House Bill 681. It's a holdover from the other day. Representative Cotton is here to explain that we had some problem, as I recall, if you're going to correct the subcommittee. Let me
go ahead.
Yes,
yeah, Mr. Chairman, Mike's passing out the another copy of a proposed committee substitute. There's some changes written in on the front here. There was hadn't been taken care of by the agency for one reason or another, but that's the proposed language you see written in there. The question was raised yesterday by Jim Duncan that the eligibility requirements on page 3, 43, 18, 1, 10 shouldn't apply to the standard state aid to construction unless they wanted to apply for that advanced funding. So those eligibility standards under 43, 18, 1, 110 now only apply to sections 105 through 135 of this chapter, which deal exclusively with school facilities construction advance account. So the front page now would, as you can see there, it would say that in accordance with regs adopted by the department, they would determine the extent of eligibility of a school construction project for state aid. So each of the school districts that apply for state aid would be treated without regard to those special eligibility requirements on page 3.
Okay, cash put out prior to 77 in section 1 on page 2 is paid back. No.
Page 51. Mr. Rhoda, I think that's just the front page, a duplicate, substitute for the front page of the original bill.
What's happening is the fiscal 77, there's no cash being paid out at all. but instead of that, they're getting 100% debt retirement on the bond, which they then, after that, it goes to 50% and then up to 80%. So,
you know, the bonds that were outstanding, they get 100%?
Right.
Yeah, but what about the school districts that paid cash?
There's no reimbursement.
Was in this original bill?
No.
Yeah, it may have been in the original bill.
Yeah, it was in it, on line 15.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, I think you're referring to some payments made by the Kenai Borough probably prior to June 30, 1977.
Yeah.
The existing law allows, provides for 50% reimbursement of those cash payments, I believe. Is that correct? Existing law, not this bill. I think that...
They picked up all of the bonds.
Okay, Leo, one thing that the original bill, the first bill you might have seen, had a provision for 100% repayment of cash put out by the boroughs prior to 1976. Mm-hmm. I think that's the way the last year's bill passed. And the department calculated that amounted to $16 million if you go all the way back prior to 1976. And I think about $12 million between 1972 and 1976. So there was a question as to what the intent was of legislation that did pass. How far did we want to go back? So the decision that the HES committee made was to make no repayments for cash prior to June 30, 1977.
All I'm concerned about is going back 1 year. I don't care about 10 years.
Okay, well that's perhaps a decision the finance committee may want to make as to what sort of previous payments that you're interested in reimbursing. But the HES committee decided to just bag the, the finance subcommittee that made the decision to disallow any cash payment reimbursement prior to June 30, 1977. Again, it's a question that I've tried to identify as far as cost. The department has, again, pegged that cost at $16 million if you want to make a blanket repayment for everything before June 30, 1977. Am I correct on that?
Is that much money, huh?
How much did it take?
$16 million.
Well, did most of it in Anchorage?
No, I think Anchorage was, I think Kenai had more than Anchorage.
Anchorage had $1.9 million, Kenai had $1.6 million.
Fairbanks had $300,000. Where does it, there's stuff sort of in the department here that might want to talk about the other.
Well, I think that what you're looking at is a period between 72 and 76, pre-72, and then just fiscal year 1977. The cost, if we were to reimburse all cash payments made in fiscal 77, would be 4.1. If you go beyond that, you begin picking up the balance of the 50% payments. And that runs, I think that the total figure is between 10 and 12 million.
Okay, then plus the 4.1.
No, total. The 16 includes 50% payments. So it would be half of the period between 72 and 76, upon which we've already paid. That would be about 5.5 million, plus the 4.1 in 77.
Okay, so if you want to pick up FY77 cash payments, it's going to cost you 4.1 million. That's where 1.6 for Kenai, 1.9 for Anchorage, and 300,000, I believe, for Fairbanks. The subcommittee decided that to not allow those payments. Now, the finance committee may make a different decision.
Yeah, there's no consideration of paying payments at all on this.
How's that now?
Under this bill.
Right. Only the cash payments made after June 30, 77, before July 1, 78. So FY78 cash payments would be reimbursed at 50%.
Cash payments.
For FY78 only. Prior to that. You can just look at the price tags and see how far back you want to go, who you want to reimburse.
Yeah, Sam, I apologize for not tracking the words, but I mean, the old law that we had said 50% of all past debt, right? Or no, it was 100%.
Last year, Hospital 89.
Is that right?
Said that prior to FY 77, we take over all bonded debts.
And said in the future, 50%.
We left it, yeah, we, the rest, the bill that the House passed.
So the only part that, and this would raise it to 80, but the only part in question is that fiscal year in between the passage of the Act, right? Essentially.
Fiscal 77 was not included in the language of last year's bill. It was an oversight.
Just the cash payments is left out.
So that's how the question arises, whether or not to fund it, at what rate to fund it.
But the way, okay, the way the debt retirement is gone, let's say prior to 77, there's 50% debt retirement. For 77, there's 100% debt retirement. For 78, it's 50%, and for 79 on, it's 80%. So even though they're not getting cash payments for that year, they are getting 100% debt retirement. So for most communities, it'll work out probably better, with the exception maybe of Kenai, and I'm not sure what debt.
Cash payment is a direct appropriation from their fund, funds to build something as opposed to borrowing money.
Right.
So if the committee does decide to reimburse all cash payments made in FY 77, that's an extra $4.1 million. We decided we didn't want to do it.
Sam, I still have questions on this page one and how it relates to the rest of the bill. Maybe they're just not understanding it. But looking at your new page one, on line 13, you're going to delete the words under AS 4318110. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay. Then what happens to 4318110 on page three? Does that remain in the bill?
Yes. That.
That applies to the construction advance account.
Well, it doesn't the way it's worded, and that still bothers me. As I read page three, it still applies to sections 100.
No, 105. It should have done a new bill. 105 through 135.
Well, all I have is new page one.
No, you should have a whole new bill as well.
Bill. I don't have a copy of the bill.
Well, oh, you only passed that page one.
I was assuming the bill was distributed.
No, we don't have a copy of the bill.
No.
One sheet. Oh, we got one sheet.
Did you look at the file, Jim?
Yeah, I did. Okay.
Where'd you do with the bill? I mean, I thought you passed the bill on.
Well, mine, yeah.
All right, that helps somewhat here.
How do I know if it's a new copy?
I thought that we had this all
the new arranged. Copy just has section, well.
The new copy can have these messages. Yeah, but you don't have these changes made up.
Yeah.
Oh, that's what we have.
Yeah, I got the new copy now.
Okay, that's
the new copy. Here's the change.
For
page one. This is page one. The other changes are okay. The other changes have been made.
Okay, then Sam, you're satisfied that the new section 110.
On your new bill there, it should read on line eight, sections 105 through 135.
Okay, I got that.
Yeah.
I guess the only problem I would still have is I don't know what kind of regulations the department would set, but.
There's somebody here from the department that would be willing to answer questions on that or discuss that.
The kind of regulation I think they should be setting would be to design type, perhaps, square footage and space requirements in the community, but not get into anything else. I'm a little concerned because of the kind of criteria that's set up in 110 that they may be applying some of that same thing to 10 because they have the flexibility to do that. And they may be trying to make the determination as to what kind of new elementary or secondary program or what the economic and social stability of the community is, et cetera. That bothers me. I'm not sure if it's really bothers me.
Well, Jim, Steve here from the Department of Education would respond probably and discuss the current regulations that the department uses and what they may anticipate as far as new regulations under this
Okay, so you can do that then.
Would you?
I'm Steve Hall from the Department of Education. I'll be glad to respond to any specific questions you might have concerning the regulations we either presently have or would envision under the passage of the act.
That's the specific question.
Okay. For the eligibility criteria for the advanced account.
I'm not concerned about the advanced account. I'm concerned about the qualifying for the basic program, which is 88%.
Basically, we see it working like this. Everybody's eligible for 80% of something. The critical question is 80% of what? And the department presently has regulations which speak to allowable square footage kinds of criteria and the kinds of, well, essentially that's the biggest thing. What we say to districts is, you have this many kids, and at 150 feet per kid, your gross square footage allowance is whatever it is. And we'll give you that kind of state entitlement on a reimbursement basis. We don't go into the kinds of things indicated for the advance account.
You don't envision any new regulations along this line then for the basic, for just being the basic 80% reimbursement?
No, sir. The regulations we presently have are all we think we need.
Do you have a list? You say that this is a primary one. Do you have a list of those regulations?
I have the regulations before me, yes, sir.
Can you read through those?
Sure. This is 4AAC 31040. Do you want me just to read the regulations in their entirety? Or briefly describe what they do?
I guess you're going to describe. We'll be here all day.
You're asking for it.
Yeah. 040 is the first section of the regulation, and that speaks to approval of plans. And essentially what this does is require that before construction begin, the district submit to the department their plans and ed specifications. It further requires that the final working documents be submitted to the commissioner at least 15 days before the bid is made. And it requires the commissioner approval under the section before the bid can be let in terms of how much the department is willing to go. What we try to do is give a double assurance, both to ourselves and to the district, that there isn't going to be a big surprise when the bills start coming in. 050, approval of purchase of non-school facilities. Speaks to the REAAs and their ability to buy facilities if they need them. 060 state aid for construction, and that specifically sets forth the kinds of conditions which the department will be looking at for the approval of projects. The real meat of the regulations are actually in the definitions, in which we say an elementary and secondary school means buildings which have been built or converted predominantly for instruction of elementary and secondary students in small schools, or schools designed to house in excess of 100 students, not more than 100 gross square feet per student in kindergarten through the 8th grade, and not more than 150 gross square feet per student in the 9th through the 12th grade, and buildings for the support of that instruction. They further define locally generated revenues, new school construction, rehabilitation, school construction costs. Perhaps those that have worked in school districts with the regulations, or in municipalities with the regulations, would be in a better position to talk to you about the effect of the regulations.
Mr. Chair, so I think, you know, without discussing the substance of what Steve has just said here, I think what he's saying, Jim, is that the existing regulations are the only ones that are going to be considered as far as the straight 80% state participation is concerned.
I think I answered my major concern I had last time.
Further questions from the committee?
Is there anyone else here that wishes to
testify on this bill? First time, second time? Second time, Mr. Raleigh?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Jim Raleigh. I represent the Alaska Municipal League, and as Steve indicated, we can in fact work within the guidelines as established by the administration, or we have an input process to them to accommodate our concerns. As I testified the other day, we had some concerns about the bill, and I think that the bill, as staff redrafted, is acceptable to us with one exception. And possibly I'm misunderstanding now the language of the bill. A statement was made that this bill goes back and retires all debt prior to 77. And that's not quite the case. It goes back to 1976 and retires 100% of that debt payment made during that year. And it was my impression that we wanted to treat the cash payments made in that same year similarly. And it was, again, our testimony in Hess that indicated that the way 78 was paid, or came out, 2 years earlier.
Yeah, for debt incurred before July 1, 1977.
Yeah, but you go back 2 years earlier to the retirement of principal, bond, and interest outstanding, notes and interest incurred before July 1. So July 1 is the date, and you go back 2 years.
Maybe Sam has a better answer, but if I understand what the Hess Committee and the subcommittee decided, we could not continue to pay the debts or cash payments indefinitely. Like, it had no end to it. If you just say before 1977, for instance, you could begin paying from the very time of the territorial days, you know, to the present. And this is what we were quite concerned about.
We're discussing page 2, section 3. It's always been confusing to me when the when you read the language, it says that the payments made by the borough or city during the fiscal year 2 years earlier. That always causes a lot of confusion, and you have to kind of look at it on a graph, a time graph. But the way I read it is that the last words of that sentence say incurred before July 1, 1977. So that means that the state is going to take over all the payments on bonds on the indebtedness incurred before July 1, 1977. What happens is the state makes their payment 2 years after the municipality makes their payment.
Mr. Chairman, that's so, but if you go down then to line 10, you will see that that same language occurs again, and that only concerns the year June 30, 1977, through July 1, 1978. You're identifying a period in which the payment's going to be made for, and it does not go back and retire all debt. You're talking about going back 2 years and retiring 100% of the debt of that year.
Which years are you concerned with now?
Well,
FY 78, they get 50% of the bond indebtedness. Pre-FY 78, they get 100% of the bond indebtedness taken care of.
For that year, for the year, 2 years prior.
Everything before July 1, 1977.
Are you suggesting then that in 1979, say the Anchorage municipality might have $100 million worth of bonds outstanding prior to 1977, and the state's going to go pick all that up?
Everything that the Anchorage has gone into debt.
Can I try that?
On before July 1, 1977, the state reimburses the municipality for the payments they've made to retire that debt.
Could you help us on that?
I don't know. I'll try.
Try, can you please.
For fiscal year pre-fiscal year 77, the state is, the organized cities and boroughs presently have a bonded indebtedness annually of $26 million. That means before July 1, 1977, they had incurred enough bonded indebtedness to generate payments on an annual basis of $26 million. What we're saying is, every year, we're going to pay everything you're paying in the cities and boroughs on school construction bonded indebtedness that was incurred before July 1 of 77. So conceivably, you're paying on bonds which were passed in 1957 or 8, and you're reaching the end of the maturation of those bonds. We'll give you 100% of whatever you're paying on school construction indebtedness which was incurred before July 1 of 77. That's what the bill proposes to do.
I'm to understand then that you're going to pay $26 million a year, or whatever the residual value would be left year after year as a retire bond.
On everything that was incurred before July 1 of 77.
Just bonds only.
School bonds construction only. Indebtedness. Yes, sir.
Bonds. School construction debt, that can be cash.
No. Not with the language of the bill.
It's meant to only retire, to have the state retire the bonds that were incurred before July 1977.
I don't read that that way.
If it means that, then Mr. Chairman, I...
If it doesn't mean that, that's what we intend it to mean. Maybe you've got some better language for it.
No, sir, I like your interpretation very much, and I certainly wouldn't argue with it if everybody else believes in the way that's interpreted.
This language of the 2 years earlier is exactly what's in SLA 120 that was passed last year, so...
And it's what also exactly what's in present law.
Yes, sir, if you look at the fiscal, or if you look at the governor's budget this year, it was not the intention, or it wasn't the interpretation, at least, of the department through budgetary process to pay 100%.
We cannot require any future legislature to spend, or any future governor to propose to spend anything. So he only kicked in 80%, even though the bill says that we'll make 100% payment. He was $5 million short of making 100%. Reimbursement to the municipality.
I see.
Mr. Chairman, the department's request for fiscal 78, which would be for fiscal 79, which would relate back to payments made in 77, was for 100% of the debt retirement.
Well, Mr. Chairman, we have no problem with the bill then.
All right.
If you decide that you want to cover the cash payments made during FY 77, it would be very easy to plug into the bill on section 1 if you wanted to do that. If you wanted to make provision for half of those payments, you could very easily do that too. It would be just a matter of the committee making a decision to cover those costs. So it wouldn't be any problem putting it in the bill if you so chose.
I got sidetracked. I don't understand for sure what all this, but what you're saying, Sam, is section 3A1 says that that the school districts will be reimbursed, or the cities will be reimbursed, for payments made for all debt incurred prior to 1977.
Yep. The way it works now, Jim, is that the present law is that the state will participate 50% in that debt service.
Yeah, I understand that.
So what happens is the borough makes their payment. They go ahead and pay the whole thing. They pay if the note calls for a $100 a month payment plan, they pay that $100, and then 2 years later the state comes back and gives them $50.
I understand that. I don't have any problem with doing that, but I want to be sure that we say in the bill what we're intending to say, because what it says to me as I read this, made by the borough or city during the fiscal year 2 years earlier for the retirement of principal and interest, it tells me that's 100% of the payments made in fiscal year 76, I guess, 2 years earlier than July 1st, 1977. It doesn't back up beyond that. It would appear to me that you'd want to eliminate some language here. Then read it, payments made by the borough or city for the retirement of principal and interest on outstanding bonds, those are other debts incurred before July 1st, 1977.
It took me a long time to understand it. 2 years earlier.
But how can you ever go backwards? Yeah, right, this is the first time. The first time, you're making payments for fiscal year 1976. Then, the next fiscal year, they'd be making payments two years earlier. But it wouldn't be going back to 1975. It'd be going back.
That's all I'm saying. It doesn't seem to be playing a fair.
We're not going to catch you.
I'll give you an example of my district. We sold bonds in 1971. We sold bonds in 1960. We had three bond issues.
Every year.
So in 1976, these are 30-year bonds. In 1976, we will pay $400,000. In 1977, we paid $178,000.
But that one year.
And 50% is governed by.
Until we get the bonds all paid off.
50% of A.
It was sold well before.
Okay, Steve, give me Mr. Year.
Say the following sentence. Payments, 50% of this payment.
At a rate of about 400. Then you'll go back and pay 100% of this, 50% of this.
That's correct.
So then the key then is to tie each fiscal year in.
That's the way it is.
It makes a bond issue as each year.
I don't want to discuss it anymore. they could word that much better, but it's fine. Give somebody something to do.
The first further testimony on the bill.
I wasn't confused earlier.
Mr. Chairman, I could just add that the standards that the department mentioned are standards that are in existence, and some of the buildings have been constructed, and the districts do feel that they can live with them. I think Service Henshaw was built in Anchorage with a statistics of about 112 square feet per student. The rural areas can build a multi-purpose room comparable to a full-size gym under the standards if they have something like 75 students. So Mr. Duncan's concerns, the districts feel comfortable that they can live with those standards.
Mr. Cotton, do we have a fiscal note on this? Do you know?
Yes, it was handed out with the bill.
All right.
Last time I was here.
Mr. Rowan.
Clarification, one question. The cash payments of the Kenai Borough committed to this is not in the bill.
Correct. Nor are the $1 million for Anchorage.
No, it's part of it.
Gentlemen, what's your pleasure?
And lady.
Committee substitute for the House Bill 681.
I heard the motion. Is there objection?
Okay.
Mr. Rhodes object. Mr. Rhodes?
Yeah, I want to amend it. I want to put amend it.
Yeah. Do you have it?
I don't have the wording of amendment, but I'll tell you what it is. It's the cash payment. Year prior to 1976.
How many years prior to 1976?
Just 1 year. The only year I care about.
Okay.
$1.5 million involved.
Is that?
Where's Sam? He said $1.9 million. See, they picked that up in the other bill and then they threw it out of the bill. What I mean is a district that is conservative. Extra people take cash are being penalized for those who issued bonds. So I think this should be reimbursed.
Mr. Chairman, you know, some communities and school districts are more fortunate than others. Like in Mr. Rhodes district, they paid cash for their schools, and they went ahead and they had the ability to fund some of these programs. And I know that I don't know. I just felt that since they could afford it, I think we have to help those who cannot afford it.
Mr. Rhodes, it seems, appears to me that we're of a policy decision before the committee, and could you make a motion in the form that we can say yes or no, and you could put your, I would suggest you could put your motion in the form that would be, express what you want to do with the appropriate language, and if it,
okay.
if it passes, why we come up with the appropriate language. If it doesn't, we don't have to worry about it.
All right. Let's see, what year is it?
Mr. Moore.
Mr. Chairman, may I suggest that if he's interested, if we're interested in an amendment to this, that the language from section 2B be used and the dates just be altered, and that would include the intent of what Mr. Rhodes is trying to do.
Which one?
Page 2, section 2B, cash payments made after, and then if we were just to insert June 30th, 1976 and before July 1st, 1977, that would cover the time period. Road seeks to cover.
Mr.
Chairman.
Page 2.
Mr. Buckle. Mr. Chairman, in our committee and subcommittee, we decided that it was a policy decision for us to decide what the cutoff dates would be. And we know that there are some municipalities, Anchorage for one, is also involved in cash payments in some of the construction previously before 1977. If we make any accommodation for other districts, then I would have to urge that we consider Anchorage as well. But in our subcommittee deliberation, we decided that we can't go back so far, that far, because it just wouldn't be practical for purposes of this bill. And we had to make a decision and limitations. And this is why we didn't go beyond 1977 period.
Mr.
Blake.
I got it right now. Page 2 of the bill, line 8, after the sentence, ends in 1977, state construction law. Process with discretion, you add, and cash payments made by the borough or cities before July 1, 1977 to pay the cost of school construction.
Is that a motion, Mr. Rose?
I so move. That's unanimous consent.
Is there objection?
Objection.
There is objection. Further discussion?
Yeah, I get a question,
Mr. Duncan.
Do we know what the fiscal impact of that is?
I believe that Mr. Cotton tells us $4 million something.
That
was for 2 years. Yeah.
Well, I'm wondering, are we sure that that's all this, the district is going to affect? I mean, I don't even know what we're doing for sure as far as.
Do you have an answer to Mr. Duncan's question?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. The cash payments for fiscal 77 are $4,513,000.
What districts are affected?
Anchorage has $1,009,000, Fairbanks has $392,000, Galena has a little bit, Cake has a little bit, Kenai has $1,624,000, Kodiak has a very small amount, Mat-Su has $189,000, Nanan, Nome, and the North Slope each have small amounts, St. Mary's has $133,000, Unalaska and Wrangell have small amounts.
Where did you add this amendment at?
Page 2, line 8.
So this will be repeated.
I don't understand how it's
being more complicated than I think about.
Further discussion on the motion?
Question.
Can I ask?
Mr. Duncan?
Well, you're amending the prior 277 numbers. I think that figure was 16 million, wasn't it?
It would be approximately 10 million. You'd be picking up.
I thought you just said 4.
That's just 77. Between the years 72 to 76, cash payments were made in the amount of 11.6 million. We have already reimbursed 50% of those. So you would be picking up the other 50%.
Is
We picked up cash payments prior to this 1 year lapse at a rate of 50%, and cash payments for 78 are going to be picked up at a rate of 50%. It might, the, we would only, if we went 50% for this one interim year, then the impact would be about $2 million, and we'd already be covered for all the debt cash payments made prior to 76. And that would probably be, in terms of fiscal impact, the most equitable, reasonable.
Would you say it's 50%?
If we went
during this, on this amendment, only 50% instead of 100%.
Right, because that way.
That's a more reasonable figure, pardon
me. Yeah, but the way the amendment, as I understand it now, there's, I'm getting information, the way it's worded and where it's inserted in the bill, the actual financial impact is not $4 million or $2 million, but it's closer to $10 million. Is that what I heard?
Mm-hmm.
Which I, you know, I don't know if I have a problem with the policy question or not, but I think that probably with that kind of an added, we've got an $18 million bill here, that's not going to get far. If it does get far, it probably be going down the tube somewhere else.
Further discussion on the amendment?
Okay.
You've heard the amendment. The motion, are you ready for question? All those in favor of Mr. Rhodes' amendment signify by raising the right hand. 1, 2, 3, opposed? 1, 2, 3, motion failed. Motion before us, so we're going to put the bill out. Is there Mr. Rhodes' objection? Are you ready for question on the main motion? Those in favor of reporting the bill out, raise your right hand. 1, 2, 3, 4. Those opposed? Motion carried. Thank you, John. The next item on the agenda will be House Bill 720. That will be a disposal of state land. Gentlemen, Mr. Buckholz can bring you up to date. House Bill 720, quite some time ago, was referred to this committee. The chairman of the House Finance Committee appointed the Finance Committee as a subcommittee of the whole, and myself as chairman, vice chairman of the subcommittee to be working on the bill. We have often on done that at times, and it's been kind of hard to keep the full committee in attendance, but the subcommittee and the prime sponsor of the bill and staff and the administration people who worked on it, and what you have before you is the results of those and that work. Mr. Bradley is the prime sponsor, will testify first on the bill. Mr. Bradley, whoever you want to come here.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to just give a brief overview. Thank you. Thank you for all the hours that we spent on this. And thank Mr. Hayes for his interest in the issue. Passed out sectoral analysis. Baldwin of our staff upstairs has done the work on this. Basically, this is an attempt, I believe, by all parties concerned, Mr. Chairman, to provide a vehicle for getting out land for the purposes of erecting housing and amending the passed statute known as popularly as the Gibney Homestead Bill, as well as to make land available for purchase. The quantums have been designated, and there's a date that's involved. Both the quantum and the date, from at least a practical politic point of view, I think everybody can understand why the administration, at least one, might have problems with that. But notwithstanding those practical political considerations, Mr. Chairman, it's probably, I'd amend that. I don't believe it's probably. I think it's necessary to take this course of action in light of the desire of the citizenry to get land. And the designation of a specific date is simply an exercise to reassure that intention of the legislature, the members working on this. Quantum to be sold is to be at fair market value, at least starting off in a lottery. The intent there is along the lines of Representative Hayes' concept, easy terms and 5% downs, the average average individual can get into a piece of property. Let me tell you an anecdote that you and I both heard, I believe, Mr. Hayes and possibly some others. At least it's my feeling that the state has no business in making windfall profits in land unless fair market value is probably the vehicle that should be used. There was recently a sale held up, an agricultural sale held up on Farmers Loop Road several weeks ago. It was stated by the administration that one piece of property there, that one lot was appraised at, let's say $3,000. The bid price ultimately was $23,000. The administration was thrilled. I was saddened. What's the difference in that? Well, I mean, it seems to me sad that the Dow Cry auction, some fellow is going to spend hundreds and hundreds of percent over the fair market value, and I'm not sure the state's, we all like to make money, because we can use the money in the general fund to do benevolent acts and necessary acts. Why, it seems to me, it seems that, I think that's a symbolic problem, and I don't have to dwell on that anymore. The provisions for how the lottery would be used are delineated. Representative Greening had a piece of legislation that's worked up to provide mental health land, 1 million acres, to be so dealt with that it would become open and available and unappropriated land, and then the monies on a certain formula would go back to their intended use. That's been incorporated, and thus frees up a lot of prime land next to municipalities along and beside townships that are somewhat land poor, I guess, like in the case of Southeastern and some others. That's been incorporated, and to the extent that it frees up land while not really impacting the spirit of the constitutional forefathers, sort of designating certain land to be used for mental health purposes, why I think this will greatly assuage the problem of land availability and not messing up the intent of the original concept of mental health land. There's also, Mr. Chairman, included page 5, line 19 in section 38, a land discount provision. And this was, at least it's the feeling myself, and hopefully others, that one of the problems that's upon us with land availability is not only land availability, but at least at the present, is the price of land. I think you and I both agree that over a certain period of time, while with supply and demand, that would adjust itself. But this at least takes takes into account the here and now and the short term rather than the long term. And that allows for an individual based on length of residency to accrue 5% per year after 18, up to 50% of the total purchase price of land, and not to exceed a value of $25,000 or whichever amount is greater. This is just one exercise, basically in a lifetime, on this land discount. But the intent there is to allow and of course there are criteria, length of residence, you know, you have to be in the state and to have an intention to stay and be a registered voter and stuff like that. But I think that's a practical, it's a key provision from a practical and equitable standpoint. I think it could be argued by people who are overly sensitive regarding state ownership of land. This was not a proven exercise. I'd argue that it was. Maybe I can just ball in if I touch basically all the key points.
We have the some provisions on leasing condition in the bill that would provide that certain lessees would have a right to purchase or receive credit for amounts that they paid previously on land that appears in the bill.
Okay.
Also certain sale procedures, that all sale, the terms on all sale procedures of state land have been liberalized from 1 to 5, and basically the same terms that are specified for lottery sales in the HB 477 bill. This now applies to all sales of state land, not just lottery sales. That's about the key provision of the bill. A series of amendments to the AS 3808, home sites, and that has been before this. That has been included in
720 all along. Can you go through a number of the provisions that were repealing or having non-applicable for the purposes of timely, real timely action on this?
Yes, sir. Again, for the record, I'm Jim Baldwin, Legislative Affairs. It was presented to us from the Division of Land that it was appropriate to make certain provisions, statutory provisions, inapplicable to the, as it were, expedited land disposals. And we received a list from Mr. Smith, the director, and indicated that he felt that for purposes of quickly cutting land out for availability, that the director's findings, the requirements for appraisal, and zoning requirements for disposal, and state adherence to local subdivision requirements would have been made in place for expedited land disposals. In addition, we did not include in the bill, and probably should be included, the requirement that the land be classified before being disposed. The language used in the bill now for the expedited land disposals anyway is designation of certain lands, not classification, not any other pre-disposal procedures. Land for the expedited disposal is just to be designated. Here it is, folks. This is what's going to be yours when we get ready to dispose of it. That's the plan. Let's say classification of land was not included, but an oversight should be included. I just mentioned it here. That's the extent of the expedited procedures.
Mr. Buckle.
Section 8 of the bill, that's page 13. Goes on to page 14. I have a question. If I understand the system where these lands were given at one time, I don't know whether they reflect the value of land as it escalates through the ages. And for instance, the value of land that were leased in the 50s would probably not compatible to the value of land today, but that's understood. So when you are getting a lessee to buy, and you have preference, he has preference in buying his leased land from the state, what kind of purchase value, what is the purchase price applied to his land? Are we using the price that he leased it for some years ago, or the current going price for that land?
I think plan here is there's basically two sales. You have a put the leasehold up for sale to the highest bidder, and then the lessee has the right to meet that bid. If he doesn't meet that bid, then it goes to first bid, the highest bid at the sale. The public auction is how it's determined.
But here he is a preferred bidder.
Well,
how does it go?
The right of first refusal.
Right. Yeah. Well, it's like two sales basically. First, you have the set of the sale price, the purchase price is set by public auction, and then someone with a preference right can come in and offer that high bid and can take, then it has the right to purchase the property over the former high bid.
But he's not getting it for a bargain, obviously.
I see Mr. Tryon is shaking his head yes. I would hate to say in every instance that he would not be. Maybe you want to comment on that now.
Sure, I'll be testifying.
Mr. Conley, do you wish to testify?
I'm Pat Conley from the Department of Natural Resources. I also have an anecdote, and that's something along the lines of listening to the chairman of the State Affairs Committee speak on lands. It's like being back in grammar school and listening to the nuns talk about sex. But more important is this bill that we have before us, this supposedly compromised bill worked out. Basically, we just have a lot of problems with the bill in its present form, although it is beginning to look much better than it originally had. I will try to be specific. I have not had a copy of the bill until a little while ago, so that I haven't put my recommendations or our recommendations in writing. So I'll just briefly go through the bill page by page and explain at least basically what we find objectionable. On page one, section D, the provisions of AS 3805, those provisions in law which are not applicable to sections A and C, we just basically find is bad public policy. Mr. Baldwin said, or alluded to, Mr. Smith's involvement with those provisions. Let me make it clear that it was not a matter of the department's endorsement of waiving those provisions for this disposal, but more of a lending of technical help to show what provisions would have to be waived. On page two, section three of the bill, the subsections B and C are superfluous in our opinion. It could be easily handled with a one sentence line added to the on line nine, added to line 10 after the word unreserved by just adding the clause general grant land provided that the land is not otherwise classified in accordance with the law. That should take care of just in one line what you're saying in two additional paragraphs. On page three, sections 041 and 042, not very clear that the lottery disposals under 042 of the 10,000 acres mandatory is also included in the 70,000 acres mandated in 041. We suggest, and I have discussed this earlier with Mr. Baldwin, that this, at least on line 7 where it says AS 3805-042 or 045 should be changed to 042. That probably would clarify it. Otherwise, we're looking at taking together possibly 80,000 acres disposal and only 10,000 acres of which is lottery sold. On page Also, section 041, A, where it requires 70,000 acres disposed of each year, taken in its entirety, requires 70,000 acres disposed of, irrespective of the options provided to the legislature under subsection B of this section. What would happen if the governor came in and said, here are three options for you, one of which is 70,000 acres, and the legislature says, well, we'll take the 35,000 acre one, then the legislature and the law, the legislature and its selecting the option is binding the department to dispose of 70,000 acres with the funding for 35,000 acre disposal, for instance. Just a point of clarification. On the bottom of page 3, where it says fair market value of the land, line 29, this is the land that is to be disposed of by lottery. We would suggest that that fair market be changed to appraised value. There is a distinction as to what fair market value is and appraised value, and I think what everybody is alluding to in this disposal is appraised value. Of course, on page 4, requirements for participation in the lobby or in the lottery. We would like to just caution you again about subsection 2 and the obvious, or not the obvious, but the questionable constitutionality of it requiring a 3-year residency. The problem we get into here is that we might like to do it, and it might sound like good public policy, but if we go to dispose of land and say you have to have a 3-year proof of residency for 3 years, there is a possibility that this provision can be tied up in court, or any disposal under the lottery can be tied up in court until that matter is adjudicated finally, whether or not the 3-year provision is constitutionally acceptable.
Mr. Connelly, why is that? Simply because there's a, because the residency requirement there that, you know,
I'm just trying to caution you on it. And essentially, what I'm trying to say is that, for instance, in our disposal program of the home sites this year, we have a minimum residency requirement of 6 years. If someone challenges that, if someone who has been in the state for 5 years goes into court and says, my application wasn't accepted, they probably can prevent program from going forward until that matter has been adjudicated.
Wouldn't the same thing apply to any number of other programs? Say, I can think of the longevity bonus for
that's probably
all
true.
All kinds of things. So, you know, it's a possibility.
It's a possibility. Is all that's all I wanted to bring up.
Okay. Okay. Thank you.
I mean, I understand the purpose behind it. Subsection 3, I think, should be handled separately. That speaks to the lottery for agricultural purposes. More properly, it should be within the agricultural section of the law, allowing for a lottery on agricultural land, and this imposition, allowable of imposition of regulation. What has been done here is that these qualifications have been taken out of 477 and plugged into this bill, and in that context, it could be handled a little better. Subsection E, starting on line 22, page 4, the application period set out in the lottery sale amounts to 3.5 months. On one hand, you're trying to shorten the period for disposal of land, and yet, in this section here, you're making a minimum 3.5 months just on advertising a lottery. Not even on advertising, but just on the disposal or the taking of applications. On page 5, subsection F, you find it redundant to the whole section which this lies in. A lottery means to dispose of by lot.
Does it hurt anything to
Well, I mean, the language.
Yeah, it doesn't hurt anything.
It doesn't do any harm.
It's just redundant.
All right.
Thanks, Tom. The land discount program on 043, of course, it's just kind of a, you're saying that it applies to the purchase price of land offered under section 41.